You are listening to the Horse Radio Network, part of the Equine Network family.
What a beautiful day for horses in the morning.
You are listening to the number one horse podcast in the world. Here's your entertaining look at the horse world and the people in it.
This is Ashley Winch in Albuquerque, New Mexico.
And I'm Kat Gunther from White Lake, Michigan. You're listening to the Quarter Horse Podcast for September 16th. Good morning, Horse World.
You've heard of Shark Week. Well, now there's something even more sinister. Welcome to Horses in the Morning Poop Week. Yeah, an entire week talking about your horse's poop. Buckle up for a slippery ride.
That's right. It's Poop Week, and we are celebrating with a classic. We're going to revisit one of our most popular segments, an interview with compost expert and homesteader Angela from last year's Poop Week. Whether you're a seasoned pro or new to the game, you'll learn something new, all thanks to our friends at Zoetis. After that, we'll change rein completely, pun very much intended, to talk about driving.
Well, she's been coming on our shows for years. She's out of New Jersey, and she's a homesteader. Her name is Angela Ferraro Fanning. She's the author of The Sustainable Homestead. She knows everything there is to know about homesteading, and she does know about horse poop because she has some very big horses who poop a lot. Remind everybody how many horses you have and what they are.
I've got four drafts now.
Yeah,
I've got a Belgian, a Percheron, and I have two Clydesdales. So I've got the big guys.
That's a lot of poop right there.
It is. We have to work hard to manage it, but we do it. We get it done.
I always, when you clean the poop, especially in the fields, I determine how big the horse is by how many scoops it takes, right, to get the poop. To get one pile of poop, like my pony's one scoop easy. Jennifer's horse, though, is a scoop. He's a big thoroughbred. He's like a scoop and a part. Yours are probably two scoops for sure.
You know, I gotta be honest, I don't scoop it because I have a flock that I use in my pasture rotation management system, and they break it all apart and it degrades and feeds the soil. So I don't pick up my pastures at all.
And you have a what that you use?
So I do rotational grazing with the horses, and then I let the sheep go through. But then I let my flock of ducks, geese, and guinea fowl go through. We've talked about the guineas before.
Yeah.
I know the guineas are loud, but they are amazing because it's gross. Okay, but it's nature. They scratch in the manure piles and they blow it apart. They're looking for the flies, the insects. They ingest larvae. And then when you have that poo that's all broken up into teeny tiny little pieces, you get a good rain through. It washes it, soaks it into the soil. You've got fertilizer. You added organic matter. And I don't have to haul it.
You need a bigger flock of birds there, Jamie. That's what I'm hearing.
Oh, man. I really want me some more guinea fowl. They're so fun.
We saw some at a farm down the street from ours the other day, and I went, oh, I thought of Angela. We had a little discussion.
So we don't need to get into that again, but you know how I feel about that.
Angela, we have you on to talk about composting, but I wanted to say, when it comes to fields, the farm rental we have now, which is down the street from our new farm, which we hopefully are going to get in next week, we talked about this in the show yesterday, dung beetles, and we've always had the big dung beetles before that are, you know, look like beetle-sized beetles.
Yeah.
Here we have the teeny-weeny little ones that are about the quarter the size of a fingernail, and there are like 100 of them in every poop pile. They, in a half a day, this poop is just completely disintegrated and take it. These are the most efficient dung beetles I've ever seen.
That's crazy. Well, you must not use, well, your deworming protocol must be good and in balance then.
Oh, well, I don't know about that, but I can tell you the dung beetles are happy. So
you're doing a good job. You're okay, doing good. A good job.
I know. I just take it and spread it around. I don't have to pick it up. I'm just like you now. So without the chickens.
There you go.
Without the chickens.
Yeah.
So you did, one time before we talked about this, can you explain the different types of composting there is?
Sure. So usually when it comes to animal manure, we're talking about keeping it up outside somewhere, right?
Right.
And so we're not going to put it in a container necessarily that we close the lid, that's typically used for something like kitchen scraps. And hopefully you're not bringing in manure from the outdoors and putting it in a bucket for compost on your kitchen counter. Hopefully we're talking all the same thing about a massive heap somewhere. And when you pile it up, there's two types of compost. There's hot composting, and then there's cold or just letting it sit. Here's what the difference is. With cold composting, piling it up, letting it naturally do its thing, it's going to break down, but it's never going to get hot enough to kill weed seeds, different pathogens, or even some parasitic larvae. So while we definitely see a decrease in the amount of manure that's in that pile, it's not technically, quote unquote, usable in a garden space because all of the weeds and grass seed that the horse has ingested hasn't broken down. So it's just going to end up coming back and growing. So this is where we say, okay, if we want to use compost, you know, for the quote unquote garden gold that it is, we need to actually get it hot enough that it's going to kill weed seeds, grass seeds. And then also as a benefit, it's going to kill, you know, parasitic larvae and that sort of thing. So the hot compost, we tarp it. And that's what we do here at our homestead is I make a good old heap, big pile. When it gets big enough that it starts to get a little freaky to drive my four-wheeler over it and dump any more on top of it, that's when I tarp it. And I mean just a regular tarp. You buy it at the hardware store. I anchor it down with bricks, and I just let it sit there and do its thing. Now, I know that there's a lot of passionate composters out there who talk about watering their compost, turning it, aerating it. I'll be honest with you, I have had just as much success just tarping it and leaving it alone. And it takes a lot less time to break down because it gets so hot while it's killing all of those things that your compost is going to be ready in just a few months, as opposed to like 9 months plus as it would be with cold compost method, where you can't really end up using it anyway.
So a question about that, because, you know, we've all been around a pile of compost that is not tarped and you kick it around and it's burning on the inside of it. So is that something that is concerning when you are putting a piece of plastic over it, like it's going to catch on fire?
You know, there are people that say that their compost heaps catch on fire, especially if they live in a hot climate. Maybe then that would be a situation where somebody would need to worry about watering it, turning it. Here where I am in zone 7, central New Jersey, I've never had a compost heap get hot enough that it spontaneously combusts into flames.
How about Florida?
No.
I feel like we're bursting into flames sometimes.
But I think the other thing that comes into play is it needs to be well balanced in terms of ingredients, right? So a lot of us think, oh, we'll just take manure out of the field. You know, for example, we talked about that just a few minutes ago, and I'll pile it up. When you do that and you don't introduce any other, we call them brown or carbon ingredients. These are things like straw, leaves, sticks, even cardboard, things that are very fibrous materials. When you don't have enough of that, your compost heap is just straight manure or even food scraps or a combination of the two. You have so much nitrogen going on, it's going to be out of balance. It's not going to decompose properly. The rule of thumb is you don't want half and half. You don't want half manure food scraps and then half, you know, all of the dead fibrous materials I mentioned. What you actually need is only one third manure or green ingredients. And the other two thirds needs to be that fibrous carbon-based material. And that is what a good compost recipe consists of. Now, am I walking around my farm with measuring cups and scales and making sure I get that just right? No. But what I am doing is I am taking the stuff that I clear out of my stalls, which not only contains manure, but contains pine pellet bedding because it breaks down faster. That's what I choose to use. And I toss that in the heap. There's fallen scraps of hay and straw that I go in there. I know there's some horse farmers around me that are very meticulous about making sure they only get manure in their heap. But that's never really going to truly break down as well or as efficiently as if you don't have a balanced carbon and nitrogen.
That's interesting.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was going to ask you about having hay and straw in it and leaves and things like that. And I was thinking, is that a bad thing? It sounds like it's a good thing.
No, you need that. Definitely. Okay. It's a good thing. Yeah.
And you don't turn yours at all. Jamie just talked about how they do hers and her husband loves to get out there and, you know, turn it. But you don't turn yours at all?
No. So when I first started composting, I had it nearer to my horse stable than what I do now. And so it was more accessible to me. And so I would go over there. I would stir it. I experimented with a thing you may have heard of where people take a massive pipe, like a huge PVC pipe, and then they drill holes in the side of it and you stick it in the middle of the heap. So that way air comes in through the pipe and then it goes out through the little holes that you've drilled in the sides and helps to circulate air into the center of the pile, which in theory is supposed to help it break down faster. I personally have noticed no difference from turning it to using a pipe as to when I just tarp it and let it go. I think the other thing is if you have a good earthworm population, they're disturbing the structure of that compost. So they're kind of in a way turning it for you.
I can't imagine the amount of dung. When I pick up a pile of poop out here with those little dung beetles, there's like 100 of them in there. I can't imagine how many would be in the compost pile right now. So yesterday I was on with Karen, who lives out, one of my co-hosts, and she lives out in Nevada, where it's high desert, right? And I asked her what she does, and she composts wet composts or, you know, hot compost, like you would call it. She called it wet composting. Mm-hmm. And what she does is she says like four piles she rotates, and she doesn't turn it, but she does wet it. And she puts everything in there, her household, you know, anything that can decompose, she puts in the pile with her horse manure. And she said she lets it go for 4 years before she uses it on the garden. And then she was complaining yesterday that she has more zucchini than God. So, because, you know, everybody plants way too many zucchini plants. I mean, you only need one.
Right.
So, you know, she said it works great, but she composted for 4 years. How long do you let it go for before you put it on a garden?
That's a long time. Yeah. So if she's wet composting, you know, that'd be one thing. And if she's in Nevada, she's in the desert. So she probably is going to have to add moisture. Here in New Jersey, I'm in considered a wet climate, so I don't have to wet it. We get plenty of rain. Nature takes care of it for me. But I tarp it. And when you tarp it, you're trapping all of that heat. And I think I could be misremembering what I read, but I believe it's 180 degrees Fahrenheit is what you want that compost heap to get to for it to be ready. So essentially, it's not even about the duration of time. It's not even about saying, oh, well, it's ready in 3 months or it's ready in 4 years. It's about when your compost heap gets hot enough and when you pick it up and you kind of sift it with your hands, are any of the ingredients recognizable? If it just looks like earth and organic matter, then you can, and the temperature is correct, then you can use it and it's considered ready. Whereas if you're picking it up and you still see hay bits, maybe bits of manure in there, it's definitely going to need more time.
Oh, that's a good measurement to use. And when you're putting it on the garden, let's say, how much of it do you use? Can you overdo it?
Well, yes and no. It kind of also depends on the ingredients are in there. So if you have not a good balance of your nitrogen to your carbon, right, your manure to your dead leaves and strong sticks, then you're going to end up having a very nitrogen-heavy compost. And too much nitrogen is not a good thing. It can burn your plants. So it's sort of another reason why you want to make sure that you're at least close to balancing out your ratios with that one-third, two-third rule. Now, compost isn't really a fertilizer. It has to break down and go into a liquid form in order for plants to drink up the nutrients that it contains. Plants don't eat solids. They drink liquid. So while compost absolutely has a lot of nutrients, it's not relevant to the plant until it sits there for a while, becomes water soluble, and the plant can actually soak it up. So rather than think about it as a fertilizer, which eventually it will be when it can liquefy, think about it as a soil conditioner. You're adding organic matter, but even more importantly, you're adding all of that beneficial bacteria and stuff we can't see, the mycorrhiza, all that. You're adding that to the soil, which is going to create healthier soil structure. So in the long run, yes, you get nutrients, but in the short term, you just get healthier soil and better organic matter. So when I top off my gardens in the fall, I add about an inch of compost just as a top dressing on top of the entire growing space. And then over the wintertime, it breaks down that way. In the spring, when it's time to put those seedlings in the ground, a lot of that compost nutrients is now in a liquid form that the plants can readily take up.
Genius.
I'm learning so much today. I didn't know any of that.
I mean, seriously, I do like the comp, but like, I don't do it. I mean, I do my garden in the same place every year. Why haven't I thought of that? Just do it now. Let it soak all winter. And then it's already in there in the spring, as opposed to me just putting it in and then it up. I've been writing that down.
Yeah. I didn't know any of that.
Plus, in the spring, we're so busy, right? Starting seeds, planting, all that stuff. The last thing you want to do is have to be like, oh, I can't plant yet. I got to put my compost in. I need to let that sit for a couple weeks. No, no, just do it now and let it sit over the winter, and then cover it if you can. Cover it with straw, not hay. Hay is full of seed. Cover it with straw. Cover it with even dead fallen leaves from your trees in your yard. That's an excellent mulch. And protect that compost over the winter so we don't lose nutrients that it contains through the sun, because it can solarize. The sun can burn it off.
Is pine needles a good option?
I was going to ask that.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Good.
Finally, a use for those things. Perfect.
We both have a lot of pine trees.
There you go.
One other question, and I'll let you go. Are there any risks to using composted manure in edible plants?
That's a great question. So if you decide, let's say you have lettuce that you planted in the spring, and you want to go through and just do another side dressing of compost for whatever reason, maybe you have too much, I wouldn't eat the lettuce right away after you apply that compost. I'd give it some time to chill out. You know, obviously that contains bacteria, both good, but also bad for our gut. The other thing that I do is I don't ever take a carrot out of the ground and just chomp on it. So the skin is edible. I like to think, okay, I am putting composted manure on there. Granted that it's not really manure anymore, it's compost. I still scrub my carrots and peel them before I just bite into them and eat them, because they are coming out of the soil. Now, if it was a lettuce leaf and the compost hasn't really touched it or done anything, then sure, I'll rip off a lettuce leaf, I'll rip off a strawberry. But anything grown in the compost, better be safe than sorry. Give it a wash. It's just common
wash
sense.
Your carrots and your potatoes.
Yeah.
Well, listen, I love you. You're absolutely fascinating. I love the fact that you know all this stuff. And I'm assuming a lot of this can be found in the book, The Sustainable Homestead.
Yes, I do have a whole chapter, I believe, on composting.
All right. We'll put a link to that. Still available, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Okay. I'll put
buy my book.
And do you have a website, Angela?
I do. My website is axeandroothomestead.com, axeandroothomestead.com.
Thank you, Angela. This has been a joy, as always. Appreciate it.
Absolutely. Looking forward to next time. Thank you for having me.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
What great information on composting. Now, Ashley, I know that today's show is all about driving. How did quarter horses get their start historically with driving?
Well, as we all know that quarter horses are famous from the quarter mile racing that they did, these horses were also indispensable for daily life on the frontier. We're talking way back when, wagons crossing the desert, you know, Oregon Trail status. We're going way back in the time machine. And these horses were not only fast sprinters, but were also strong enough to be workhorses on farms and ranches, which includes, of course, pulling plows, wagons, and carriages. So as these settlers moved westward, the quarter horse was with them and was further developed by being crossed with the hardy Mustangs. And this gave them even greater strength and an innate cow sense, making them ideal for ranching and cattle work. This combination of speed, power, calm, and their willing disposition made them highly suitable for both work and transportation, solidifying their role as the go-to breed for all aspects of a settler's life, including pulling all kinds of carriages and wagons.
Wow, this just shows how versatile they are, honestly. We've said it so many times on here, but quarter horses really do it all.
They can do everything with a smile. Yeah. That's why we love them.
With a smile, most of the time. Sometimes it's sassy.
As long as it wasn't your quarter horse.
Oh, I know my old show horse Teddy, who passed away, he would freak out if a cart was around. He did not like it being near him. So some of these horses are versatile. Others of them are scared of carts.
Or they're just, you know, opinionated.
That's a good way to put it. Do you have any experience with driving?
I do. As a matter of fact, my quarter horse, Boo, who I went on to train in dressage and eventing, and he was just the ultimate all-arounder, also drove. When we bought him originally as a trail horse, he came with driving experience, and it was really fun to learn how to drive. And usually every Christmas in toasty Florida, we would hitch him up to our big old wooden cart, and we had jingle bells that were on. Forgive me, listeners, because I don't know all of the names of the leather straps. There's so much that goes into getting a horse connected to the cart. They're like, it's not just like a saddle and a girth, y'all. It's a lot. But we had jingle bells and we would go caroling, and it was just so sweet. And he was happy to do it. And I think for him, it was also a nice change of pace too.
Yeah, I love that. Oh my gosh, that's so festive.
Yeah, well, in the 80-degree weather, nothing, yeah. Nothing
you're
like
trying to be festive,
going caroling in your swimsuits and
on a cart though, on a horse cart.
That's right, we did it on a one horse open cart.
Yep. By the palm trees we go.
That's right.
Well, that's really cool. I don't have much experience with it. I remember some horses at some of the barns I trained at or trained out of. They would do driving and just seeing like, and usually the drivers I saw were big. Like I remember this 18 two-hand huge bodied quarter horse just pulling a cart, and I don't know. It was cool to watch, but it scared me a little bit. I'm a bit of a wuss, I'm not going
to
lie.
Well, you know, there's something to be said that I can't wait to talk to our guests about this, but you know, we're so used to being in control as a rider can be on the back of the horse, and there's something about that difference, you know, you're not on top, you know, contact in the rein, contact on the saddle, you're behind. Mm-hmm. And at least in my own experience, it certainly felt like you were more out of control, even though that, you know, wasn't necessarily the case and we were safe. And it just, it's really weird.
Yeah, that's true. Because when you feel a connection with the horse, it's like through your seat and through that energy. How do you do that when you're sitting?
Exactly.
Yeah, maybe that's why it freaks me out a little bit.
It is a bit of a loss of connection, loss of control, mm-hmm. at least in my opinion. But I'm sure our guests will educate us.
There's probably some way that they feel it. Yes, I'm excited to hear more about that.
I know. Well, with that, let's pop right into our first guest.
Raised in Millersburg, Ohio, Marion began breaking colts at just 14 before working with top quarter horse trainers. In 2013, he founded MT Performance Horses, which he now operates with his wife, Christy, and their three children in Wooster, Ohio. Welcome, Marion.
Grew up driving horses, really grew up Amish. So I've been driving horses since basically I was in diapers. Then when I got into the quarter horses, you know, I needed another class for a couple of them. And that's just kind of went from there.
So do you think your background being Amish and driving is like when you were in diapers helped you to better work with your quarter horses in the driving classes?
Oh, absolutely. Just some, like the breaking of it all. It's just something I was very comfortable with, like getting one started in the cart, I guess. Something I was very comfortable with.
Okay. What does that process look like? I'm really curious because me and Ashley were talking in the intro to this episode about how do you feel the horse when you're not on top of them and you don't feel it through your seat? Do you like feel it through the reins, or if you could describe that for us?
Yeah, very much. Very much like you guys have all like rode hunt seat horses. It's a very similar feel in your hands. Your reins kind of do turn into your legs as like an aid to get more power, get more lift. And then there really is, I feel like there's really a balance. There's only so much you can do behind them in the cart. So like it really translates. The better they're riding, the better they're going to be in the cart.
So with your Amish background coming into the quarter horse world, I can't imagine what kind of things you saw that were different on both accounts. What are some maybe tips or tricks that you brought from your background into your current training program? I'd love to hear more about that as well.
I don't know that there's that much specific tips or tricks as much as just general horsemanship. I grew up with horses. Horses were a way of transportation. So, the overall care of a horse, the overall, like reading a horse, like that's something I was doing at a very young age. And I would go more so on that route. Cause the horses I grew up driving and the horses we show today are obviously very different. But I would say it's more so in the overall horsemanship end of things, the stuff that has benefited me.
That makes perfect sense.
So how do you break a horse to drive? Like, what are the first steps? If a horse has never seen a cart, how do you get it from that moment to showing?
So preferably I start out with a horse that is a show horse. So it knows, like, it's desensitized to the environment at a horse show. It knows it goes to the horse show and has a job. I mean, that's the preferable way of doing it. We've done it the other way, but I mean, basically, you know, so that horse it's desensitized to the harness most of the time. Sometimes, like the first time you put the crupper on one of them, they might not be a huge fan of that. So that's something to kind of work through. But yeah, I just start getting the harness on them. We lunge them in the harness, generally line drive them the same day, in long lines and go from there. It really can be a pretty, like on a show horse, it depends on the horse, but it can be a pretty quick process. I always tell people you can see what it's going to be very quickly, but to get it finished and ready to be a great, you know, as competitive at the Congress or the World Show or wherever, that takes a while.
So are all of your horses that you compete in driving with, do they also ride? Are they all arounders, or do you focus on one discipline at a time? What does that look like?
Generally, yes. They're also showing the hunter under saddle as well. Sometimes they do. I've had some that do more events than just the under saddle. But I do think it's a great event to add to your hunter under saddle horse. And I always feel like once they figure out all they have to do is walk and trot, they love the driving. It's a nice change of pace. But generally they do the hunter under saddle as well.
That sounds exactly like cat speed of things.
That's the first thing I thought was like, that is my level nowadays.
So, Marian, do you find when you are doing, I'll call it cross training, do the disciplines complement each other? Are there things that, separate from just a change of pace, knowledge that the horse can bring to either side of that coin?
Absolutely. I think it makes a huge difference. I think it's great for them. And like I kind of said earlier, the better they're riding, you know, the better they're going to go drive, because it really is. We do a lot of stuff. I mean, we do a lot of stuff to try to get to a spot where we don't have an issue in the cart. And with that, like I always say, if I'm riding a horse and it spooks and goes the other way, that's no big deal. But if I'm in the cart and it spooks and goes the other way, that's a huge problem. So, on that side of things, if I have a hunter under saddle horse per se, and it's not great in its neck, you know, it just doesn't want to go to the bridle very good, driving it is not going to help that. But if I have a hunter under saddle horse that is, you know, it's at a spot where it's ready to do more with its life, that's definitely where the driving can be beneficial and offer a little change of pace for them.
And kind of on that thread, do you look for horses with the hunter under saddle breeding? Like, is there a specific bloodline you look for that you know will be good at driving?
Yeah, I'm sorry about that. But yeah, I don't generally look for a specific breeding. But generally, I mean, you can see under saddle kind of what they're going to look like in the cart. I think a big, powerful trotting horse is just beautiful in the cart. And you can kind of tell what they're going to look like under saddle.
So when you compete your horses in pleasure driving, do you ever do any other kind of competitions? You know, I've seen, like, and forgive me because I'm not a driver, but I've seen where people take their driving horses over almost cross-country courses. Do you ever do other types of driving with your horses, or just the pleasure driving?
I try to just stick with the pleasure driving. You know, I always joke around with my wife that I'm going to, like hitch a pair that I have here double and drive them around the farm just for the fun of it. But I'm not sure how well the show horses would appreciate that lifestyle.
They're like, hey, now I signed up for walking and trotting. Okay.
That's right. Well, Marian, we always ask everybody this last question. Can you tell us a funny story with your favorite quarter horse, or like a funny show ring moment, or something along those lines?
Oh, a funny show ring moment. Well, I can tell you my most embarrassing show ring moment in the driving. probably, I think it was 2022. I was driving without permission at the Congress. The senior was split. I made the finals. We were going the second way. He was being great at the road gate. I was wide open, and I hit the wall. And it sounded like a shot going off in the Celeste. So, yeah, that was definitely my most embarrassing moment. He stayed pretty cool, probably loped half the class off, spooked everybody else. He stayed pretty cool. So, yeah, I was, yeah. That's my moment right there. He came back and showed good in the amateur right after it then, but yeah.
Well, I'm glad you're okay.
Live to tell the tale.
Yep. Right. Yep.
Oh, well, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, guys.
From early morning feedings to late night barn checks, horse care follows a rhythm, and Chewy helps you keep in step. Whether it's grooming for that shine, geared to protect every ride, or the supplements that power their stride, Chewy delivers what you need when you need it. Fast shipping, flexible auto ship, and trusted brands mean you can focus on the feel of the reins, not the stress of the supply run. Your horse counts on you, and you can count on Chewy to match the beat of your barn life for every season and every reason. Start your order today at chewy.com/equine.
Simplify your quest for fall deworming. Only Zoetis' Quest Plus Gel controls both encysted, small, strongyles, and tapeworms in a single dose. Consult your vet for assistance in the diagnosis, treatment, and control of parasitism. Wendy Lash, alongside Kevin Carr, operates Kevin Carr and Wendy Lash Show Horses in Wabash, Indiana. While they still maintain a small breeding program, their primary focus is on training and showing all-around horses.
So, Wendy, we're excited to have you today. My first question for you is, what is your background with driving, and how did you get into it?
So, the first horse I got into driving with was actually one we bought when I was younger. My boyfriend bought him to make him a barrel horse. We bought him as a yearling. And his legs went 100 miles an hour, but he went nowhere. So that was my first pleasure horse, too. We decided to do the pleasure stuff with him. We made him an all-around horse and taught him to drive. He was incredibly good-minded. And he wasn't a bad mover. He couldn't run. Wasn't Congress quality, but I mean, he was a nice horse, and that was my first driving horse, and I had a lot of fun with it. That's kind of how it got started.
That's very cool. So one thing I always wonder is, how does driving differ from riding in regards to steering? Like, obviously there's the reins, but what are the mechanics of that?
So when you're driving, you've got to keep your horse straight. And of course your only connection is pretty much their face. So what you do is you teach them to go to the bridle, kind of like you would for a hunt seat horse. And in order to straighten them, if you've got one, so I had one that used to want to run crooked. So what you've got to do is you've got to get a hold of their face, and you've got to actually use your rein to crack them over to teach them to get straight. That's kind of what you have to work with, you know. I guess that's the easiest way to explain it. The rest of it comes off pretty much voice cues. You know, in the beginning, you're either cracking a lot or you use a whip. Usually once they get broke, it gets way easier. You don't have to do it so much. The last driving horse I had was extremely lazy. We used to practice at home, having Kevin stand in the middle arena when I cut across the reverse, try to keep him walking fast enough because he would become a snail. Cutting across the middle. But then it's pretty much just your voice cues. That's probably the best way I can explain it.
Are those voice cues, are they like standardized, or is that, you know, like whatever the driver wants that to be?
I mean, you can kind of do whatever you want. Most of the time it's jog, trot.
Okay.
You know, for the road gate, a lot of us shush. And you know, if you got a big class, they usually get up and go pretty quick because everybody's shushing.
Well, that's what I was curious, is if, you know, they would hear someone else giving a cue, if they would, you know, listen to the other person or the driver, or what that looked like.
Yeah, it's kind of like just when you're riding. If you're in a class and somebody's kissing a lot,
mm-hmm.
and you happen to have a horse you need to kiss off,
mm-hmm.
a lot of times they're going to listen to them.
Yep.
I didn't even think of that. Uh-oh.
Yeah.
Panicking so, internally a little bit.
It's not that bad. The biggest one, I think, was for the last horse I drove. You know, we don't have a lot of classes around here that have huge drivers. So, you know, you might see five horses if you're lucky in a class. And then you get to the big shows and there's 12 in the class, you know. And so when you've got a green one, it takes a little bit for them to get used to, you know. So like your first year of driving one, you know, it takes them a while to get seasoned if you can't get to shows that have that many horses. And they will get a little reactive to the traffic, you know.
That makes a lot of sense because, you know, it's not like a flat class where it's 40 horses running around. It might be 10, but it's also 10 wagons or carriages. I mean, that's a whole lot of commotion. That actually is a great segue to my next question I had for you, Wendy. I wanted to talk about the equipment. What would you say is the average cost someone could expect to get started in driving? You know, what would they spend on the harness and the cart just for like a beginner? Because I'm thinking over here, you know, I'm going to spend, let's say, $3,000 on a saddle, $500 on a headstall. You know, what are those general costs, would you say?
So if you can, if you can get shopping around, you can buy a nice harness. Usually for about $1,200, like a nice patent leather one that's in good shape, you know, not cracked up or anything. And a show cart, if you don't want to get the Easy View ones, there's still plenty of older carts out there that are in great shape. You could probably get one from anywhere between $1,500 to $2,500. And then if you want an Easy View, they're a little harder to find a used one. You're going to spend anywhere between probably $3,000 to $3,500 if you can find a used one in good shape. Otherwise, if you want to go that route, you're probably going to have to get a new one. They're just harder to find.
A little bit cheaper than a $20,000 Harris show saddle is what I'm hearing.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. We like that. So what advice would you give to a quarter horse owner that's interested in trying driving and they might not know if their horse would tolerate it or accept it? What would you say to them?
My biggest thing is I make sure you send it off to somebody that knows what they're doing. You can ruin a driving horse real fast. You can ruin their confidence. And when that happens, it can be scary. So I would make sure you send it off to somebody that knew what they were doing and willing to take the time. And it's just the biggest thing is they just got to have a good mind. You don't want something that's overreactive. You know, it's just, you're kind of limited there. A lot of my friends, when I, you know, last horse I was driving, they're like, are you nuts? That's suicide jockey, you know? So, I mean, it's just get somebody that knows what they're doing. I'd say that'd be the biggest thing. And then take it from there. If the horse, you know, can handle it and shows potential, it is a fun event.
Well, and you know, you make a great point. Kat and I were talking earlier about how it almost feels like you have less control when you're driving versus when you're riding. Could you tell me your thoughts on that statement and how you feel when you're driving?
I mean, I do feel like you got a little less control than you do on a horse's back. Just because you're limited to what you can do. You don't have your legs around them. And if they get startled, they got dragging that cart behind them. They've got blinders on. They can't necessarily see what's around them, you know. So that's where, with me, they've got to be good-minded. Or I probably wouldn't hook them, you know.
And this is something that always goes through my mind when I'm watching the driving classes. Have you ever had any issues in the ring where someone fell off the cart or a horse ran into another horse? I always just get so concerned because, like, you have so much hooked up to them. What happens?
I've never personally had a crash, but the year I showed Orange is the New Bay, it was his first year showing at Congress and his first year showing in the driving. And that whole morning was kind of a train wreck. I can start with there if you want. We had I brought him down, and I usually pull his blinders when I walk him through. And he'd been just so good at the shows. And we went to drive in the morning to warm up. He got a little up. That was the most drivers he'd ever seen in his life. It took me about 5 minutes before I hooked him to the car, just let him chill out. Got him hooked up. He was fine. We get done warming up, and just as we're getting ready to leave, a storm comes through, and that tent outside the Celeste starts a whipping. And I had left his blinders on going back, and he checked out. Kevin had already headed back with the cart, so I was there by myself. We've got garbage flying by. By the time we got back to the Attaquan building, he had already ripped his tail out, freaking out. So we went and lunged, got him ready. We get in the pen. We get ready to go show. And there was a horse in there that was known for spinning in the cart. And Chuck Briggs warned me going in, do not get near him. Do not get near him. Like, he could not be more animate. And I'm like, okay. But they're sending us in, you know, you got to get in. We were a little bit behind him. And sure enough, they called for the road gate. And this thing did a 90-degree turn in the cart at the road gate. I was far enough back. I got pulled up. There was another girl in front of me. She just barely made it between that horse and the rail. I don't know how she did it. I mean, she had probably 2 inches of room to get through. And, of course, they exited them. And then the rest of that class, I think we had 2 more spooks in that class, all in one spot after that happened. And then mine almost thought about doing it at the last road gate. So, I mean, it was one of those things, you hope your horse got whoa.
See, now I have anxiety. Anyway, on a different, let's do a 180 on a good note here. Can you tell us your favorite funny story with a quarter horse that you've showed or just were training? Like something that'll make us laugh.
Oh, God, I'm trying to think. That's a tough question.
It is the toughest question we ask. We pride ourselves on being real hard-hitting journalists over here on the Quarter Horse Podcast.
Breaking news.
Oh, God, the funniest thing while showing. I mean, I've had some horses do some silly things in the class. I just laughed it off. I don't know if it was the funniest, but I remember showing my old stud horse. And a horse had taken a dump in the pen. And as we're going past it, he never broke gate. But he dropped his nose and turned his head as far as he could as we passed it up to sniff it. I mean, I don't know if that's the funniest, but that's the only thing that's coming to my mind right now.
I think it's a good one. I like it.
And I couldn't do nothing but laugh. I mean, he never broke gate. He just, you know.
He knew his job. He just kept going.
Yeah, I mean.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for joining us today, Wendy.
Okay, thank you for having me.
Thanks so much for tuning into the Quarter Horse Podcast on Horses in the Morning.
And a big thanks to our Poop Week sponsor, Zoetis.
Be sure to like, subscribe, and tell your friends all about the world's favorite breed of horse.